You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 28th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella. And Evan Bernstein.
Awesome.
Hi, I'm not possessed. Hi, how are you?
That was a zombie, Evan, not a demon.
Yeah, get it straight.
And Jay has professional zombie noise experience. When I was doing my haunted corn maze, Jay came up with epic zombie noises.
Wait, you paid Jay?
Yeah, did you pay?
Yeah, you're right. You paid him?
No, don't get ahead of yourself.
We paid him.
So he has
in, like,
amateur
cider donuts and stuff.
And candy corn.
No, the win was that... You know, so Bob ran a professional haunt for years, and I was doing all sorts of like sound effects. And at one point, there was like a couple of like hillbilly characters that were killing people, and I made like a little like almost like a mini radio play between these two characters.
It was epic.
But one year, I got really sick. About you know, it was like what, mid September when we were setting everything up. So I get crazy sick. My voice was totaled. And then I realized, oh my God, if I record myself with my sick voice and then I lower the pitch and do a couple of other things, it made the absolute best zombie noise of all time. Then
oh, man.
I was eating celery with that voice, which sounded like bone, you know? It was like just yeah. really visceral. It was awesome.
Wow.
I was like, that's like a weird aside.
It's very creative. Yeah.
So one more thing. I with the Halloween theme, just about finished Super Ghouls and Ghosts. You guys remember that game?
What'd you play it on, Jay? Was it just like a PC?
Just right off the internet.
There's
tons of places.
I love playing old games off the internet. Fun.
Yeah, so I was...
nostalgic.
I brought me back. I'm telling you. Tell me about this game.
Well, you're basically a knight going to save the princess, and it's a side-scroller type game, and it's all has to do with the undead, and, you know, you're just defeating all these kind of demonic enemies and whatnot. And you know, you have like all these different weapons you can pick up, and each one of them has a different special effect and everything. It's a great, great
game. That was
a
PC
game. No, that was an actual
Sega console.
Sega.
Yeah,
see, that sounds to me like
Sega.
I used to play a game on NES called Simon's Quest. Did you guys ever play that game?
No, how was that?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I
like
know
it would go nighttime, and then all the normal characters would turn into like ghouls and stuff, and you'd have to kill them.
Oh, I love it.
It had like fun music.
You know, I've been thinking about Halloween a lot. Nothing will, even the adult like haunted mansion activity that we did, doesn't beat like a real like, you know, early teenage night out for Halloween with your friends. Kara, did you do that? You run around like crazy and do weird
stuff?
Oh,
yeah. And not just that. I mean, my birthday is October 19th. So from the time I was born, like my first pictures in my family photo album from my first birthday, there's like a pumpkin cake. And so from the time I was born, my parents did up my birthday so Halloween themed. They would build like haunted houses in the garage and we would have costume contests. It was amazing. It's the best holiday to have a birthday near.
I didn't think about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because it's not religious. It's not like something that where you have to kind of go to church or where you have to be with your family. It's not something where like there's anything sad associated with it. It's just pure fun.
Yeah, my younger daughter was born October 1st, so it's in October, and that was enough of an excuse to always do like a Halloween theme
for her birthday.
Yep, everything turns orange on October 1st.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the pirate birthday we did for Autumn.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah,
it was just
Julia,
like, was it? Oh, no, yeah. Oh, that's right.
Autumn's was the villainous catnapper.
Yes. That was great.
right. The mystery.
Her birthday gift that year was a kitten.
Aww.
And we built
two kittens.
There was two because we had to have two. So I gave the other one to my other daughter.
Right,
but
two girls.
It was for Autumn. We just was jonesing to have a cat. And so we built the entire birthday theme for the party around her and her friends having to rescue these kittens from villainous catnapper.
That's so cool.
And they had no idea that at the end of the whole adventure, they were rescuing actual live kittens.
And then she gets to keep them.
And then she gets to keep them. But it was so adorable because she was young. You know, this was a few years ago. One of her friends like, do we all get kittens?
No.
I'm not giving away kittens as party favors. Sorry.
That's up to your parents.
And Bob was villainous catnapper.
Yeah, I actually acted.
That's amazing.
Jay, you were the detective, the dog based detective, right?
I was the British detective trying to help the kids solve
you
the crime.
Like, yeah, you were like Detective Doberman or something.
Yeah,
you were aww. Awesome, Jay. You were hilarious.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on with the show. Bob, you're going to tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, this week for the Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Alice Hamilton, who was a pathologist who was instrumental in causing sweeping changes in the safety of people exposed to dangerous industrial metals and chemical compounds in the workplace. Now, Hamilton, get this, she was born in 1869. She died in 1970. That makes her 101 years old. That's a good run, damn good run. She was a professor of pathology at the Women's Medical School of Northwestern University initially. She held many positions over the years, including assistant professor in a new department of industrial medicine at Harvard Medical School in 2019, making her the first woman appointed to the faculty there in any field. So impressive. But even more, much more impressive though, a lot of her discoveries or her advances have to do with the ramifications of the Industrial Revolution. Now, of course, this revolution was an amazing boon to society in countless ways, but the impact on the health of workers was often horrible. And this is called industrial medicine, and it was not being seriously looked at in the United States as it was in other countries. And she noticed this and started looking into it. And she wrote an article about it in 1908. And soon after that, in the same year, she was appointed to the Illinois Commission on Occupational Diseases, which was the first such commission in the United States. And then over the years, she worked for many other state and federal investigations looking into the impact of many workplace substances like mercury, radium, benzene, carbon disulfide, hydrogen sulfide gases, many, many of these nasty chemicals that were that people used in work, and there was very little or just not nearly enough care taken into, you know, what the workplace should be like in order to deal with these safely. She basically became a pioneer in the fields of occupational epidemiology and industrial hygiene in the United States, and her science was so spot on, she had a tremendous impact on the waves of health reforms that swept the nation during that time and affecting countless, countless lives. So remember Alice Hamilton. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when they're playing with acid at work and they say to you, hey, watch this.
or catch.
Yeah. So it is incredible that just 100 years ago, the standards, workplace standards, were so terrible. I mean, essentially, companies had no responsibility for the health of their employees or even just the welfare, the basic safety.
And also there were a lot of, you know, industrial chemicals and stuff that people didn't really know what they did until much later. And so even if there were basic safety, you know, measures that were taken, oh, wear gloves. Oh, doesn't seem to help, you know, or right. I'm wearing a mask. No, but you needed a respirator. I think a really good example of that, I just recently finished, maybe two books ago, Tom's River by Dan Fagan, and I hugely recommended it. Won the Pulitzer last year in science and environmental nonfiction. And it's about this big Superfund site in Tom's River, New Jersey, from this company that just was spilling horrible things into the soil, into the water, and into the lungs of the people who worked there for many years. And I mean, obviously, there's some question as to if they knew it or not, but either way, it made a lot of people sick.
Mm-hmm. Kara, did you ever hear of a Mad Hatter?
Like in Alice in Wonderland?
Well, the term actually, I am correct, and I believe I am, that term actually came about because in Danbury, Connecticut, a town right next to where we all grew up, they would make the Stetson hats, and the hats are made out of felt, and they use an enormous amount of water in the production of hats in order to shape them and everything that they need to do. And there was mercury in the water, and people that worked in that factory went nuts from mercury poisoning, and they called them the Mad Hatters.
Yeah, mad as a hatter. Because they would get neurological disease from the mercury. That's right.
And that ended up being a good colloquialism. It's good that they didn't call them the Mad Haberdashers. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Mad as a haberdasher.
That's more of a baseball.
But wait, I
kind of
like that,
Kara.
Let's start a movement.
So perhaps the biggest news going around this week, the one that I've seen repeated most often on social media, is the headline, Red Meat Causes Cancer. Jay, help us unpack this this science.
Get it?
Horrible news, folks. Experts from the World Health Organization have said that eating processed meats, you know, bacon, sausage, beef jerky, all the good stuff.
Stop.
Sausage is processed?
It's causing fracking cancer in humans. Like, what? Specifically, colorectal cancer, right? Yes, I looked it up. It's rectum and colon cancer. So
yep.
You had to look that up.
And I just wanted to make sure. And on top of that...
Here's looking up your old colorectal.
On top of that, red meat probably causes some disease as well.
Wait, this is true?
Well, yes, but let's get into the details. So the short answer is yes, it's true, but the devil is in the details. So the IARC, which is the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer, reviewed 800 studies, and they had a meeting of 22 health experts, and they concluded the following. They said that there's a link between eating red meat, which is pork, lamb, and beef, and pancreatic and prostate cancer. They also said that they classified processed meats as carcinogenic to humans. And like I said before, this is smoked, salted, cured meats, foods like bacon and ham and jerky and sausage, like everything I love. they included those in group one list, which like has other nasty things in it, like tobacco and asbestos and a whole bunch of other stuff. If you eat 50 grams or 1.8 ounces daily, your risk increases by an estimated 18%. And then as a comparison, though, they consider that smoking increases your chances of getting cancer by 2,500%. So 18% is not anywhere near as bad as picking up a habit like smoking or using tobacco products. Now, I know what you're all doing. You're doing a calculation in your head because I did this. Like, how big of a serving is 50 grams or 1.8 ounces? Well, it turns out that that's equal to eating about a hot dog or two measly slices of bacon. Two slices? Who eats two slices of bacon?
Yeah, but that's every day. That's every single day.
Who eats bacon every day?
A lot of people do. Now, listen, but get real, though. I eat two slices of bacon while I'm cooking, you know, like when you're standing.
That's true.
And your risk goes up as you eat more. Now, yes, you're right. This means you have to eat 50 grams or 1.8 ounces of that list of meats every day. Not that hard to do, guys. It's not a lot of meat. Now, red meat was classified as probably carcinogenic in the IARC's group 2A list, which is nowhere near as bad as the one list.
It's always about dose, right? That's the thing. You could say anything is linked to anything. Everything causes cancer. Everything. You know, it was interestingly, not too long ago, a group published a study where they just went through 100 sequential ingredients in a cookbook and then did a literature search and found that half of them cause cancer and the other half protects you from cancer. It was like 60, 70, 80% of the ingredients that they found. It's like there's everything causes cancer. The thing is, it's all about dose, and that's where you get lost in the weeds on these studies, right? On the World Health Organization recommendations and looking at the literature on this. Again, part of the reason I have to emphasize is that we can't do the definitive study, right? You can't force people to eat meat and other people not to eat meat. So they're always just following people.
They can force Jay.
Well, yeah, I'd sign up for that study.
You'd have to do
a longitudinal study, too. It'd have to be over, years.
Most of the data is observational, which could be very well controlled as best as they can. But the thing is, you can never control for all the confounding factors. And that's another area where, you know, this data is a little bit tough to parse at times.
Now, to bring things into better perspective, though, so when I said 18% before, that's not the real world percentage. So your lifetime risk of getting the colorectal cancer is 5%. And if you don't change your diet at all and keep eating meat at that high rate, you know, like the 1.8 ounces or 50 grams a day, it only goes up to about 6 or 7%. So it's 1 to 2% increase. You know, and some people were saying, you know, for such a low increase in number, don't even worry about it. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't eat healthy, and it is a good idea to regulate your overall quantity of red meat and processed meats, absolutely. But as an example, quitting tobacco would give you a massive benefit versus, you know, I'm going to dump some of the red meat out of my diet where you have a very small percentage of chance of actually, you know, improving your health or avoiding cancer. Now, a lot of the media outlets were doing a ridiculous, you know, headline bit, like Steve said earlier, you know, bacon or meat is dangerous, you know, is dangerous as smoking and everything. And that is nowhere near close to accurate once you dig into the weeds on this thing. So in the end, I'd say, you know, we need more research on this. It's a hard thing to research, but definitely more research is helpful. You don't need to become a vegetarian. They did a study and they showed that there's, you know, virtually no difference in the overall health of healthy people, meaning that people that are slim, that exercise, and, you know, you take a slim exercising vegetarian and a slim exercising moderately, you know, red meat eating person, and there's no health difference whatsoever.
Like eating sausage every day, like you're probably putting yourself at more of a risk of heart disease.
Yeah, I think so.
Than of colorectal cancer. And that's, I mean, that's the confusion, I think, with the way that the CDC classifies these things, is they're based on their how sure they are that it is a risk, not how risky it is.
Right, exactly.
So for them to say this, you know, we think there's a good chance that this has a link to cancer, or this is a probable carcinogen or a possible carcinogen, but not it is this likely to cause cancer, which is why, of course, asbestos and tobacco and red meat are on the same part of the table. And that's why everybody's really confused in the headlines.
Right, which is why some headlines are like, it's as bad as tobacco, which is wrong. It's orders of magnitude not as bad. You know?
It's just they're just as sure that, of the link.
there's a link. Right. And the other thing is, like, there doesn't appear to be any lower level of tobacco exposure where the risk disappears entirely. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Secondhand smoke seems to cause. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
If there is a lower threshold limit, it's pretty darn low. A little bit of smoking, in other words, is a little risky. You shouldn't smoke at all. But it's not clear if there's any risk to a little bit of red meat or even occasional processed meat. Yeah. So.
And surely that was part of their report.
Not really.
Right?
Not really.
Probably not.
Well, first of all, the full study hasn't been published yet, so it's just sort of a brief summary that everyone's going on. So that, you know, the full technical details have yet to be published. But you also, I mean, I looked, because I wrote about this recently as well, because about a year ago there was another study that said red meat causes cancer. So, okay, wait a minute, let me dig into this. In that study, the only statistically significant difference in overall mortality was between people who ate the highest amount of red and processed meat. I mean, just processed meat. There was actually no mortality difference for red meat. There was if you compared the highest group to the lowest group of processed meat, there was a statistically significant difference. So basically, if you believe that one study, you have to eat a pound of bacon a day in order to have increased risk of mortality.
Whoa.
The other problem with this data is that there's so many confounding factors. It turns out that people who eat more red meat and more bacon also smoke or overweight,
yes,
don't exercise, don't eat vegetables, and, you know, have a host of all the other risk factors that you would expect for all the same things. Now, a lot of the studies try to control for these confounding factors, but it's hard to do that. It's hard to completely eliminate that. And the other thing you have to think about, if for whatever reason people who eat, you know, more red and processed meat have all of these known other risk factors, what unknown risk factors are we not controlling for that they also happen to? It just seems like they don't take care of themselves generally. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to factor all of the things out, you know, that go into that. And so it may just be a marker for an overall unhealthy lifestyle, not a risk unto itself. That I don't think the research has really answered that question, except for, I believe, at the higher end. I think we could say at this point in time that if you eat lots of bacon a day, that's a health risk. Duh. Right. Or if you like live on red meat. Yeah. Like at the extremes, I think we could say that, you know, we're probably there. But I'm not convinced that the evidence shows that there's any health risk to eating moderate amounts of red meat and occasional processed meat.
What about you hear all the time that some of the cancer risk seems to be linked to like the amount of carbon, like barbecuing, blackening meat.
Yeah. Blackened food is.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's
that's
really
right.
hard to separate that out, too. If we're talking about red meat, you know, a lot of people barbecue it.
Well, that was part of the WHO's report. They said that it's plausible because of the way you cook it, you know, that you end up with these known carcinogens in there. So that's part of it. Of course, you could blacken chicken, too, and that will also give you the same thing. But
it does taste better, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, they tend not to do that. So that's the other thing. You could also just not cook your meats under high heat, the kind that causes it to be blackened, and that would reduce the risk as well. So at the end of the day, you know, when I wrote about this, I said, you know, we're left with what we already knew to be the case, which is the best advice is to everything in moderation, right? Eat everything in moderation. Make sure you eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. You know, don't overdo the meat. We're still there. This doesn't really change that bottom line recommendation. This is not evidence that you're better off having zero meat in your diet. That this the evidence does not show that.
Being serious, like I only have bacon maybe on the weekend. You know, like one weekend breakfast, I'll eat some bacon.
I have it a few times a year.
That's it?
Oh,
that's
wow.
You're not a big pork eater?
No, that's not good.
Yeah, I mean, we never cook almost never cook it at home. So it's like when I'm at a conference having the breakfast buffet, you know, a couple times a year, that's when I have bacon. That's it.
I eat bacon a lot. I don't know. You know what? Like, I'm not a doctor. So I'm going to preface this by saying that. I'm not a doctor. But I have to think that eating meat, if you're a meat eater, obviously if you're a vegetarian by choice, that's different. But eating meat and also eating warm food, which I see a lot of times these like raw food diets, like confer a psychological improvement in your life that for me outweighs this 1% increase in a risk.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like, you know, your people are free to make choices that they make. You know, we drive. Mm-hmm. Driving is a convenience that increases your risk of dying in car accidents. You know, people snow ski for fun, and that is certainly a risk. You know, we do all sorts of things that confers risks on us that we accept because of the net effect on our lifestyle and our happiness or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think just like I just wouldn't overdo it. Just like being, you know, back to that. Just don't live on bacon. You're probably going to be okay. The risk will get small enough that it's like into the background that I don't worry about it too much, you know. Now, to give you one more thing to worry about, Kara, you're going to tell us about a new risk to the environment. All the big poop is going away.
I know. Yeah, so I love it. I wrote down at the top of this news item, if we lose the whales, we lose their poop. And that matters more than you'd think.
Yeah.
So there's a new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS, called, can't help it every time, called Global Nutrient Transport in a World of Giants. And it details just what you said, Steve. Because we have lost a significant population of our global megafauna, so think back to dinosaurs and mammoths, and now to the speed at which we're losing whales and elephants and rhinoceri and things like that, the way that nutrients traveled across land, sea, and air have been drastically affected. So the study authors actually proposed that historically, you know, a long time ago, marine mammals, seabirds, anadromous fish, these are the ones that go from fresh to salt water in their life cycles, like for spawning. So they're going between these two different bodies of water, and also terrestrial animals, animals on land. They make up a kind of specialized poop ecosystem where their poop is actually recycling nutrition from the deep ocean to the surface water. So think marine mammals, whales and dolphins and things like that that can dive deep to land via seabirds and anadromous fish. So these are things that can move between the land and the water pretty readily. And then once on land, these nutrient hotspots are spread throughout the land by these large megafauna. So according to the study, we can really break down the numbers. The authors estimate that the ability for animals to move nutrients away from concentrated patches on land has decreased to about 8% of the pre-extinction capacity. So if you think about all the large megafauna that was roaming around, so much of that is now gone that we've seen a reduction down to 8% of previous numbers in nutritional scattering.
And previous meaning when, Kara?
Previous meaning like prehistoric, like when we were the era
15,000 years ago. Or millions of years ago or 15,000 years ago?
15,000 plus.
Okay.
And they've also seen a drop of about, to about 5% of the historic value in the ocean. So this is not a drop of 8 or 5%. It's a drop to 8 or 5% of existing levels. And for phosphorus, which they specifically focused on, this is of course an important nutritional building block. It's actually a building block for life. Upward movement in the ocean by marine mammals, they estimate is about 23% of its former capacity. They also say that, like I mentioned before, seabirds and anadromous fish provide an important transfer of nutrients from the sea to the land. And they think that that has declined to less than 4% of this value as a result of just a total decimation of seabird colonies and fish populations. Now, unfortunately, as we just said, a lot of this extinction is already done. It's already occurred. There's kind of nothing we can do about it. But we still do have a very large animal living in our oceans. you guys know, what's the biggest animal that ever lived on the earth?
The blue whale,
The blue whale, of course.
Biggest whale is huge.
It can reach 100 feet long, 400,000 pounds. And as one site I found, I was reading on National Geographic, put it, their tongues alone can weigh as much as an elephant, their hearts as much as an automobile, which is crazy.
Wow,
like, it's
awesome.
Hard to put that in perspective. So these guys move between 5 and 20 miles an hour, and their typical migration routes are like from the poles to the equator. They go really far. And they also live in every single ocean on the planet. They feed at around depths of 300 feet, but they can dive as deep as over 1,500 feet, which really contributes to this nutrient cycling from like deep ocean up to the surface, because of course they're mammals, so they have to come up to breathe. So obviously you can see how they might contribute a lot to this global nutrient transport. But all is not lost. The blue whale is on the endangered species list, and it is, like, it's sad when you think about it. There are only a few thousand left. There used to be estimations, say, around 350,000 in the oceans. And they have no known predator. So this is actually a good thing. Humans, of course, are the only known predators of the blue whale. So they were commercially whaled for a long time, but that practice has been banned. Their biggest threats now to habitat loss are ocean acidification, ship strikes. It's not uncommon for a ship to hit a blue whale, which is very sad. And fishing line entanglement. And also, they eat krill. You guys remember the whole thing with the baleen and the krill gets caught. Yeah. So krill is dying because of climate change. We're seeing lower krill populations. So these things are contributing to habitat and to life loss. So of course, as the authors posit, if we lost the blue whales, that minimal nutrient cycle that we have left, based on, as you remember, animal poop, could be more severely weakened. And that would actually have a downstream effect on fish populations and on produce. This is something we have to think about. Agriculture. We need these nutrients in the soil in order for plant matter to grow. So these things are all delicately interwoven, even though we don't often think of something as far away as a blue whale in the deep ocean having an effect on whether or not my carrots can grow large. So guys, protecting whales and migratory fish and seabirds could make a big difference in restoring at least somewhat this nutrient pathway. And the good news is that the population of the blue whale is increasing due to conservation efforts and science diplomacy across the globe.
Plus, blue whales are awesomely cool.
They are so cool.
Oh my God,
they're the loudest animal. They're the largest animal. They travel the farthest. I mean, they're amazing.
Yeah. All right. Well, Evan, apparently scientists have invented a tractor beam from either Star Trek or Star Wars. You could choose your genre.
or any others. A team of researchers at two British universities, the Universities of Bristol and Sussex, have created the world's first fully functioning sonic tractor beam, which is capable of suspending, moving, and manipulating small objects using only the power of sound waves.
They need to put that into a screwdriver form.
Oh, that's so smart.
Sonic screwdriver. Size of the object that they were able to grab, per se, was only 4 millimeters in
So when
diameter.
You say grab, like,
no,
they were
4 millimeters wide.
How is it being manipulated?
Not just pulling it, pushing it, positioning it to where they wanted. They were able to actually control the effect. And here I'll read it to you. It's pretty much how it works. They used sound waves to generate an acoustic hologram, in which they were capable of suspending a 4 millimeter wide polystyrene ball in space. And it's an array of 64 miniature loudspeakers. They're called transducers. And it surrounds the polystyrene ball with high-pitched, high-intensity sound waves, creating an acoustic force field. And this force field sort of takes on the shape, if you had to visualize it, of tweezers. Hmm. So that if you had something small enough, like this little ball, it'd be capable of lifting it into midair, moving it to the left, to the right, on all three axes, X, Y, Z, and pulling it all the way in as close as it possibly
could. So it really
could
bring it up into some sort of a trapdoor.
Yes,
yeah, but is
yes,
it pulling it or is it pushing it from the other side?
Like from underneath?
No, it's grabbing it. It's actually grabbing it. Tweezers.
I don't understand.
Yeah, but you said that it surrounded the polystyrene balls. Does that mean, so do you have to surround it or can you project it from one specific point in space and pull and push that way, right? You know what I mean? Or do you have to completely surround it, which would make it less cool, I think.
You have to completely, right, you have to completely surround it. In other words, you can't move it off the grid. So basically you're on this square, 64 miniature loudspeakers. So picture those in a square 8x8.
So it's not really
you're locked into locked into that.
Evan, can these bastards teach me how to do it in my living room so I can, don't have to get up for the remote? Like, that's all I care about.
Well, maybe. So
you can miniaturize your remote.
Depends how small your remote is.
I've tried to scream at the remote, and it doesn't move or anything.
The tractor beam uses ultrasound at a frequency of 40 kilohertz. People can only hear below 20 kilohertz. So at this scale, you're not going to hear it. But projecting out this technology, if you were to be able to build something large enough, say, to move a human being around using this method, it would have to be done at much lower frequencies. And they're saying that's the downside of that. It would be really loud. It would be really disruptive.
So they'd have to make it within the spectrum that we can hear. Aren't there like supersonic, am I wrong here? Like there's like weapons that are ultrasonic. I shouldn't say supersonic, ultrasonic, that like make you poop yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. They can they have it mounted on a truck. I've seen that.
Yeah, so like even if you can't hear it, there can be physiological effects of like very intense sound waves, right?
There's the myth of the brown note, the subsonic frequency that makes people poop themselves, but I don't know.
Oh, is it a myth?
I don't think it's actually true.
Oh, yeah. I thought that there was some sort of like military weapon that's been used before.
It's called the brown note.
The brown note, you ever hear that term?
Applications. Okay, so, well, you want to talk about a little bit about the applications? What the hell is it good moving for?
I'm sure there are supervillain applications.
Balls around? Well, definitely supervillain action. Now, okay, so first of all, it's based on sound. So what does that eliminate? Space. You can't use it in space. No sound in space. So you're pretty much screwed there. Well, as the authors or lead author was saying, single beam levitation could manipulate particles inside our body for applications in targeted drug delivery or acoustically controlled micro machines that do not interfere with magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs.
Right.
Have they done it on an ant yet?
And no, they have not done it on an ant yet, at least not that
I've read.
I think
it'd be cool to see how it affects an animal.
But I think this could be a boon for things like manufacturing, if you want to manipulate, you know, fine particles and orient them in space in, you know, any way you want. I mean, I'm sure this could be very helpful.
Yeah, manipulating delicate things you don't want to touch. You know, small, delicate things.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right, touching it could actually, like, change its structure
or
something.
Right, right. So have you guys heard of whole body cryotherapy?
Yes.
Oh, is that like getting in a cold refrigerator and feeling good after?
Well, that's the claim.
I feel good.
This is like Joe Rogan, who is a friend, but also very open-minded, sometimes to the extent that his brains fall out. He does this a lot. I see tweets about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yep.
Joe, come back. Come back
it's
to
just,
science.
It's another spa pseudoscience fad. That's the bottom line. But here it is. You get into a cryotherapy chamber that either your head could stick out or it could be the whole person in there. And they cool it down. It's at negative 240 degrees Fahrenheit.
What?
For 1.5 to 3 minutes. You heard me right.
Doesn't nitrogen freeze?
Yes, that's what it is. It's the they use nitrogen gas to.
But the air is that cold. They're not touching liquid.
You can't touch anything.
Yeah, yeah. The heat exchange is very slow just through the air, I'm sure.
But still, you're in there for 1.5 to 3 minutes at $40 to $100 a pop.
What?
Whoa.
No. So this isn't just like, you know, when I go to the spa, I go to the Korean spa and there are these different rooms and they're like, this one gives you salt cures and this one get, and I'm like, whatever, it just feels good because it's warm. But they're all free. You just go into the different, this you have to pay for a 3 minute treatment.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
My God.
The reason I wrote about it on Science Based Medicine, it was triggered by an unfortunate incident, which becomes one in our series about how pseudoscience kills. Over the weekend, I think it was, or last week, a young woman, Chelsea Ake, was found, and she was a manager of a spa that had a cryotherapy chamber, and she was found in the morning by staff having been in the chamber overnight.
Oh,
no.
She apparently was frozen solid. So she must have passed out in there or got accidentally stuck. Apparently the doors don't lock, which makes a lot of sense. There shouldn't be any way to lock somebody in there. So
there also shouldn't be any way for it to run longer than 3 minutes.
Right.
Or a button on the inside to shut the whole mechanism down. A kill switch on the inside.
But she was alone And she probably passed out is what happened. And then once you lose consciousness and you're alone, then that's it. Game over.
That's it.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Using cold as a treatment is in and of itself is not pseudoscience. Just like, you know, there are legitimate uses of magnets in medicine. But the spa version of it, like the spa version of anything, is pretty much crap. You know, it's pseudoscience. The claims are that the extreme cold has an anti-inflammatory effect. That's actually semi-legitimate. That's under study still, but that's not an implausible claim. There's also the belief that it may help muscles recover from either injury or exercise, right? So it's very popular among sports, you know, stars who are using it to recover from exercise or after playing.
Oh, again, heard of that.
Yeah, they immerse themselves in an ice bath.
Yeah.
They use ice baths as well. So, which also doesn't really have a lot of good evidence to it. So there have been a number of systematic reviews looking at using this extreme, you know, cryotherapy for recovery from sports or injuries. And the evidence is preliminary and mixed and weak. You know, there's some slightly positive evidence, but the reviews say there's no good studies, basically. The studies are all poorly designed. They're not well controlled. They're too small. So we just don't know, you know, based upon the evidence. So any claims being made for it go or exceed the evidence because the evidence is all preliminary and low quality. Same thing for inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. The researchers generally think that there's really no reason to think that this is more effective than just icing your sore knee or whatever, just doing local, you know, therapy, rather than this put your whole body into a cryo chamber for 3 minutes at this extremely low temperature. Then, of course, if you go to alternative medicine sites, to them, it treats everything, right? Then they go, they have all their bullshit hand waving, you know, explanations that it puts your body into survival mode. So the blood rushes to your core where it picks up extra nutrients and then brings them to the rest of your body and detoxifies and boosts the immune system. All bullshit, right?
Where's that evidence?
What does there's mean, no in your core? What's your core?
Well, you know, the like center of your body.
Core muscle, yeah.
Supposed to your extremities.
Like abs.
Yeah, supposed to your extremities.
Torso, yeah.
I didn't know if this was just some like mystical part of your body where all the nutrients are supposed to go.
Well, the nutrients.
Core exercises.
Because you don't have nutrients in your rest of your body. Anyway. And then, of course, they say it'll cure cancer and it'll treat whatever ails you, right? That's like the extreme alternative medicine BS end of the spectrum. So at the more plausible end of the spectrum, you know, for sports injuries or for recovery from exercise, the evidence is just preliminary, not that convincing, but there hasn't been any really large, definitive, well-controlled studies. At this point, we just have to say we don't know. Now, how safe is it? Well, you know, if you do it perfectly, it's probably fairly safe, but that's the rub, right, is like with anything, there's a risk. You can get probably the biggest risk is frostbite. Even if your socks are a little sweaty, that could be that moisture will freeze to your foot, and that could be enough to cause frostbite. So you got to be really careful.
Clothes?
You can't be touching any surface. So you got to wear socks and gloves, cover your ears. So if your head's in, you know, you got to cover your lips and your ears, etc. So yeah, you're not completely naked.
So I'd have to like take out all my piercings if I
yeah, you can't
like
have any jewelry. Oh, yeah. No piercings, no jewelry, nothing metal. Can't be touching skin. Absolutely.
I would imagine that people get injured every once in a while because of how
because they don't follow the rules.
Yeah, I mean it's like anything, it's not risk free. And of course, this was a kind of a freak accident, but it, you know, this is the risk of having this stuff around, of doing this, of having spa cryotherapy. The benefits implausible and unproven. The risks may be small, but they're there. You know, in my book, it's always not worth it. All right, Jay, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Last week, I played this sound. Any guesses?
No.
Any guesses?
The cosmic radiation background to the universe.
The robot from Logan's Run.
No, guys, that is a Rapman 3D printer.
Yeah, cool.
Oh, 3D printer. Gotcha.
Isn't that interesting?
What was it printing? What was it making?
It was making a figure, I think, a human figure. So the winner this week is Michael Caruso. He said, I'm guessing that it's a 3D printer, but I can't name the brand, though. Like, you'd be
nice.
You fail, Michael. Oh, my gosh.
And this week's worst guess, but I loved it, James Koltas said, it's a poorly greased merry-go-round.
Those 3D printers are getting pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So moving on. This week's Who's That Noisy? What is this?
Hello, SGU listeners. This week's Who's That Noisy is tricky. What could it be?
So, guys, please do send me in any ideas that you have. I'm having some fun conversations with people, sending me some cool stuff. And also send your guesses to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
So I had lunch today with a friend of mine who's a physicist. He's actually a string theorist. And I was telling him about my segment, What's the Word? And he said, you have to do canonical. It's one of those words that just so fits the description, like stochastic. So when you hear the word canonical, what does it make you think of?
It is the epic example of something.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's the epic example. So a lot of people read this a lot and they kind of get it in context, but sometimes it doesn't have a very clear definition. And the reason for that is because it's very context dependent. It depends on what field you're looking at. So the typical usage in a scientific context is something that's accepted as being accurate and authoritative or relating to a general rule or standard formula or according to recognized rules or scientific laws. So like in mathematics, for example, the word canonical indicates a particular choice from a number of possible conventions. And this convention allows a mathematical object or class of objects to be uniquely identified or standardized. In computer science, canonical is the standard state or behavior of an attribute. See, at a certain point, all of these words start to feel meaningless. It's borrowed from mathematics where, as this website says, it is used to refer to concepts that are unique and or natural, conforming to well-established patterns or rules. And it's typically used to describe whether or not a programming interface follows the already established standard. You'll sometimes hear it as canonicity or canonicality. But across science, you often use it to refer to an early theory or a dogma that offers up some sort of standard. So like in quantum mechanics, canonical is synonymous sometimes with the Hamiltonian approach, which Bob, you may know about. I don't fully understand it, but it's a method of approaching quantum field theory. In genetics, a canonical pathway is an idealized or a generalized pathway that represents common properties of a particular signaling molecule. A good shorthand there is to think of a canonical pathway as the one that's typically used, and a non-canonical pathway is kind of the road less traveled, even though it's still a pathway that is used.
I know that poem.
So it's spelled C-A-N-O-N, canon. And so that's the interesting part. You just said it, Evan, canon. What does that make you think of?
Religion.
Religion.
You're right. The same kind of what I said. Something is canon.
Civil War.
It is like accepted. It is it. It is.
Oh, it's law. It's
part of the Holy Scripture.
Scripture.
So this is the precise etymology of this word. It has a lot of meanings in different contexts. You know, a collection of books accepted as Holy Scripture. A complete list of saints is also referred to as a canon. A rule or a body of rules or principles, you know, in art or philosophy. Almost all of these definitions date back to the early 15th century, in which canonicalis meant according to church rule. Previous to that was canonial, not canonical, but canonial, dating back to the early 13th century. And there's also some argument as to whether that more modern, even though you could say that that's like a Middle Ages definition, can be traced even earlier to the ancient Greek canon with a K, which is similar to an English cane or reed. So not uncommonly, a reed was used for measurement. So that link between canon and a rule and a standard could be either a convergent or a divergent, you know, as we know from evolution, I'm borrowing those terms here, definition in nature. So it could be that this word actually developed out of two different places and didn't come together to meet, or maybe the Greek canon with a K predated the religious usage in the Middle Ages.
We also use it a lot when we talk about fiction, like this fact is canon. It's part of the official story.
Oh, you're right. Instead of like spin-off stories or fan fiction. Mm-hmm.
All right, a couple of quick emails. The first one's not really a question, just sending us an interesting link. Eric Schoberg from Minnesota writes, Tom Hanks lashes out at cancer quacks after his wife's battle with breast cancer. We talk a lot about celebrities, you know, who we have to sort of separate the art from the actor because oftentimes celebrities believe nonsense or promote nonsense. And
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, Gwyneth Paltrow. Pretty, yeah. So it's nice when like you like the characters that an actor plays, and it turns out the actor's also a nice person or smart or at least isn't the typical crazy that you get. So Tom Hanks' wife had breast cancer, and he was in an interview. He was talking about it. They were very first of all, he and his wife Rita Wilson, who's also an actress. They were very open about it. You know, they weren't hiding the fact, and you know, she underwent standard therapy and is doing very well apparently, which is great. But he said in an interview, it's funny, as soon as you come out about cancer, there's this odd kind of backlash that goes along with it. There's a predatory philosophy that happens where people find out that you have a certain illness, particularly cancer, and they will try to make money off of you, pushing procedures that might have a degree of science to them. And there are others that are absolute quacks just trying to make money. He goes on to say, you should Google the word cancer, everything from you must eat peach pits to go to this clinic in Bolivia and you'll be cured will come up. Very succinctly in the interview, he characterized the situation. There is an absolutely predatory culture out there. Once you are public with the fact that you have any illness, but again, cancer definitely at the top of the list, well-meaning people who are just trying to help are steering you towards quackery. But of course, the sharks in the water would all love to sell you, you know, their nonsense. And I can't imagine how much worse it must be if you're a celebrity. So it's nice that he came out and just was unabashedly saying, yep, this is all quackery and they're just predators. Next question. This is interesting. So we talked last week about Back to the Future, and I mentioned to you guys that there was a video about how Back to the Future predicts 9/11. And we got a few emails saying that the video was actually a Poe, I said, I try so hard not to be taken in by satire. It happens every now and then because it's just so hard. But if you recall, in 2005, Nathan Poe made a statement that I think, you know, crystallized what a lot of people had observed, that anything, any extreme view, any view that's extreme enough becomes impossible to parody because the parody becomes indistinguishable from the genuine thing, right? So conspiracy theories, for example, are so crazy that if you tried to parody conspiracy theories, there's no way for anyone to tell the difference between a parody and the real thing, unless, of course, you have some kind of wink or nod or tell, you know? You got to give it away.
Unless it's satire. Yeah, and they use humor in it.
Right. Or, you know, the Onion did it.
Well, some people have been taken in by Onion articles because they just don't get humor.
It's rife.
So I looked more deeply into this because the Back to the Future Predicts 9/11 video had no tell. It was totally dead serious. It was actually took me a while to try to wrap my head around this. At the end of the day, I don't think it was satire. I don't think it was a Poe. Now, the couple of people pointed out that the company who made it was Apophenia Productions. You guys know what the word apophenia means?
What is apophenia?
Apophenia is basically pareidolia.
Brain disorder.
It's the tendency of humans to see patterns and randomness.
Right? Oh.
So they thought that was the tell, but I don't think that's the tell. I think because they're using apophenia to refer to the human tendency to see patterns, but not necessarily implying that the patterns are not real. So here's the thing. The video was put together by a group of people as part of the Sync book, and their project is that they describe it a community exploring the impossible, artists and seekers looking at the interconnected nature of all things. So they seem to be taking themselves seriously. It does not seem to be a satire site. So it's not, as I said, and actually this is what I said last week, it's not that he thinks that the producers of the movie knew that there was a conspiracy where they knew that 9/11 was going to happen or anything like that. They just think like the universe is all interconnected and that this interconnectedness shows itself in these types of ways.
Right.
You know? So does that make it a Poe? Or because it wasn't a real conspiracy. It's just a manifestation of the synchronicity in the universe. But to me, it took itself seriously. I still think from everything I can see, it takes itself seriously. And so that means it's not satire. It's not a Poe. It's just not a conspiracy. It's this other thing. It represents a different philosophy, this interconnectedness, not a conscious conspiracy.
Well, at a certain point, if you can't tell the difference from the outside, and if there is no obvious nod or wink, does it really matter? Because it has the same
effect. I agree.
Effect.
That's the other point I was going to make, Kara. Exactly. At some point, it doesn't matter because you're throwing something out there that the world will take as legitimate, you know, unless you make You have to have some obvious satire. This happened to me. I wrote an article 10 years ago now about alternative engineering. Yeah, alternative engineering. Yeah.
I love that article. It was one of my favorites.
To me, it was over-the-top satire. It was, you know, using alternative engineering as a metaphor for alternative medicine. And it was full of puns. It was full of all kinds of humor. I was contacted by a senior producer from 2020 who took it totally seriously and thought it was real.
Oh, my God.
And I was shocked. And so I added at the front of the article, this is satire, you know, just to say, just to make sure there was no doubt, because I don't want to ever do that. I don't want to ever put something out there intended to be satire and have anybody take it seriously, because I think it's counterproductive. Well, coming up, we have a portion of an interview we recorded with Dr. Dean Adel while we were at TAM 2015. The full uncut interview is available on our YouTube channel. So go to YouTube, look up The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and click on videos. We have a bunch of videos up there. The most recent one is the videotaped full interview with Dean Adel. All right, well, we're being joined here at TAM 13 by Dr. Dean Adel. Dean, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
All right, welcome back. So we had you on our show a couple years ago, but this is the first time we're actually meeting in person.
That's right. So, absolutely. Yeah. You look different than on the radio.
I look different. I'm taller on the radio. Not as gray. More svelte.
Yeah. All right. But speaking of radio, I have to get this in because this has been actually, for me personally, 34 years in the making. So I'm sorry. I'm going to hijack this.
You look 28.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're supposed to return that kind of compliment.
You look like my son. How's that? Look, I've been listening, obviously, to you on the radio since the 1980s. As far as I'm concerned, you're the trailblazer, and were it not for all the work that you have done, I'm not sure that any of us would be here podcasting right now, and I think our younger audience doesn't have a real appreciation for the work and the trailblazing that you did. You were doing science-based medicine, frankly, before anyone knew what science-based medicine was, and That's you were doing fantastic. It to a massive audience before there was, you know, obviously any podcasting or anything else. Like you had said in your talk today, you were the first syndicated radio talk show across the country, and I just think that's absolutely fascinating, and because I've been listening to you since I was a boy, it's just a tremendous honor to actually have you here and on our show.
Well, thank you so much. I do really appreciate it. I've not let a lot of those kinds of things in, because you know what this business is like. It's been very, very intense, and I just did what I did. We were talking. Didn't even feel worthy to be here to give a talk. I mean, there's experts here who know more than I do about everything.
No, but I think you saw by the audience reaction that, you know, yes. you are speaking to the home crowd, and they very much appreciate the work that you've done.
Well, that's very, very kind. You sort of make a grown man cry.
Yeah. All right, we can move on to the harder question.
Yeah, but that's now cut me to shreds. Go ahead.
No, but that the I was surprised here. I knew that, obviously, that you were a trailblazer. I actually didn't know until you said it on stage that you were the first syndicated talk show.
Yes.
Radio, that's amazing.
That's
of
right.
any kind of it.
There were networks
medical,
then. Yeah. There was Larry King on the Mutual Network, but syndication was a struggle. A lot of people tried it. As you know, it's become successful. And ABC took the first attempt at it with Talk Radio Network, and they had about 65 markets. All the talent was in L.A., and I hopped on board that after doing a local show, but they didn't like the idea of paying for satellite costs out of San Francisco. And I got a call one day and say, I got good news and bad news. I said, all right, lay it on. He says, bad news is you're going to be fired tomorrow. The good news is, and this is the president of the company talking to me, he says, I'm quitting my job and you and I are going to go into business together. We're going to show them how it's done. And that was a guy named Ed McLaughlin, who was the head of ABC's talk radio deal. And the guy went on to do Rush Limbaugh.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So he did it. He really did it, and then it all kind of followed after.
And in case anyone in the audience doesn't know what syndication means,
yes,
can you give us a technical description?
Yeah, syndication means you go out there and you sell that show to individual stations, whether they're CBS or ABC or Fox or whatever. It's not coming as a network where it's forced upon the station.
Right.
So you have to sell it. So when you go into a market, the way it usually works is you give the show for free to the local station. You take back three of the advertising spots, and they get to sell the rest. Mm-hmm. And if it's popular, it works for them. So it really, of course, this is health, so it's universal. Mm-hmm. Where the bias against syndicating talk radio was it's got to be local issues.
Yeah.
But that turned out not to be true. And, Rush and others tapped into something nobody really thought was there. I remember listening to his tape and I says, are you kidding me? No one's going to listen to this. Okay. So he can be wrong once in a while.
Dean, at what point did your audience get to a size where you were like, what is happening here?
To the size, you mean?
Yeah. Like when you found out, like at one point you heard a stat and you're like, we're blowing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like when was that and when did that feel?
You know, it's very funny because, you know, like what you do here, it's in a way, it's lonely. Mm-hmm. You're not talking to real people like you just were. And I'm sure it's a different feeling it is for me.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And looking at an engineer who's sitting near board reading a newspaper, you know, and maybe someone who's handling the calls for you. And it never really hit me until one day I said something funny on the air. I don't know what it was. And I thought to myself, wow, if you look at we were up to 8 million listeners a week at one point and saying, can you imagine the sound of a few million people laughing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that would be like 10 candlestick parks of people laughing. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. And then it was a little frightening because you let that in and all of a sudden you're getting, I remember one time doing a CPR program at Candlestick Park, in front of 50, 60,000 people. And I said, this is not 50,000 people. This is just like a radio studio. Just calm down. Look at the grass. Yeah. Take the microphone and don't really let it in. So it was that moment when I kind of realized it. And maybe that made me feel isolated. I have to say that I think I'm a shy person. I'm easygoing and I'm social and all that, but basically the whole rest of the game makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I can stand in front of a television audience and a radio program and all that and do those kinds of things. But even speaking here, you know, it was funny. I was thinking to myself going on, you know, this may be your last public appearance. And feeling that little bit of the heartbeat, mm-hmm. it's kind of fun, you get the problem for you guys are you're so relaxed, you just naturally, each other, this is just a conversation.
Yeah,
you don't even think about the people out there that might be hearing it, which is where you want to be, but sometimes you can get so relaxed, you let down your guard and it's like, okay, what are we do next, honey?
We have the benefit in that, we pre-record, we're not always, broadcast live, it's very rare that we ever have done that. So there are certain advantages built into that. Whereas your medium, mm-hmm. What you say goes out.
Yeah, I know.
No taking things back.
Do you ever, you don't edit your stuff, do you?
Yeah, we do.
For time, is that important?
Well, for time and content.
Or if you say something stupid,
it's a lot. So the podcasting, standard, I think, is they're very edited.
Okay.
The part of it is I want to pack as much content as possible into the time. And so if there's like a 30 seconds where like I might be editing, I'm like, there was no new information in that 30 seconds. I'm just going to cut that out. And that allows me to keep more meaty content in the show or, whatever. Like that was that joke funny enough to keep in? I can make those kind of editorial decisions.
Sure.
And also I want these guys to be relaxed. And so I don't want them to be editing themselves too much.
Yeah.
And so they say things that are maybe close to the line of what I think is acceptable for the show. And I have to decide if I think I'm either going to keep it or am I going to let it through. So I'm editing for a lot on a lot of levels at the same time.
But we take more risks during the recording.
So that means we can take more risks. We can take a lot of risks because if it doesn't work out, who cares? I edited it out.
And on a live show, you have to be so careful. When you first started, was there a delay built in?
There is usually a delay. You have to learn to not count on that, but it's with the audience. Yeah. People will call up and say the darnest stuff, it's up to you get a good call screener, which you have to have. You get people who are drunk, talk radio is a very, the untold story is it is very ageist in that they don't like older people. And you're doing a show on health, you're going to attract a lot of older people. The advertiser wants 25-54.
Yeah.
So always thought someday someone's going to catch on to this and they're going to pose people to call a show with a different voice, same question, and an older sounding voice, same question, and see how older people are cut out of the equation. So we really fought that very, very hard, and it was difficult because a lot of our clients, a lot of stations around the country, you know, talk radio station in Texas is struggling, you know, to get their ratings. And I don't want a bunch of old people crabbing about this or that, so forth and so on. So the challenge was to keep it entertaining, sounding young, but, you know, not being biased like that. And so a good call screener is critical in a live, you know, commercial talk show.
And that's the person that, like, will talk to the people as they call in and then do, like, a super fast interview, right?
Yeah, they are. I tell you, some of them, the best ones I've ever had, they go, hello, we're not talking about that today. Hello, we're not talking about that today. Okay, hang on. I mean, that fast.
Wow. Yeah.
Because the more you scream, the better quality calls you're going to get. And we wanted to have, because, you know, I can't talk about aching backs all the time. And we like to mix in talk about issues and things maybe I've pissed people off about. I can say that, right?
Yeah, you can say pissed off. Yeah.
And things like that. So there are a lot of components, to it, to keeping it. And of course, you gotta, that 15 minutes, you gotta keep people through their breaks. And then we started doing things like, you know, you've learned to develop the quiz into something that keeps people interested. Great. Yeah. That was great. You had me riveted. I'm clapping. So we do things to keep people across the advertising break. And then advertising. Oh my God, sometimes you get horrible ads and that bores the hell out of people. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of factors going into the front lines of that. Then plus the politics and the religion and the idiocy. I mean, I'm on in San Francisco, but I'm also on in Texas and Alabama and all these places. And, you know, learning how to navigate that. I think I found that the subject of health, people, you know, were more self-interested in their health that they would, you know, lay down their arms, so to speak, to deal with me, unless I went over the, you know, crossed the line. And I just had to. I just had to be honest. And you start talking about, you know, as I mentioned in the talk, so many religious issues were important national issues. You couldn't talk about healthcare without talking about politics. And people's religion influences that. And I remember one day saying to a guy, it was about during the fetal cell debate, and I remember putting the question out in frustration, saying, okay, here's the question. Your daughter is dying of a disease. I'm holding a tube. It's a cure. It will cure her. She's going to be dead in 2 months. And she's dying. And here is a cure. And it was derived from fetal cells. No, the fetus wasn't killed for it. This would have been, quote, garbage. Sometimes you get gross to get people's attention. It was going to be thrown out in a lab or, you know, in some fertility center. Would you allow her? Well, 10 out of 10 people calling said, no, I wouldn't give it to her.
Wow.
And I said to myself, wow.
They are lying.
what do you think? Do people feel that strongly about these principles? They're so confused, you know, thinking that you're out there killing babies to get these cells. And so it was a constant learning experience to stay alive. And when I'd get threatened, you know, I remember a call from, it happened to be a station in Texas who called our friend, you know, we know at Premier, you know, and said, okay, we're taking it off the air. He just mentioned something about blah, blah, blah. And I says, you know, live and die by the sword, but there are times when you have to make that choice. And there are also always other stations in town. If it's a town or market large enough that there's more than one talk radio station. So you can say, that's fine, drop our show. You'll see us across the street. They've been wanting the show for a long time. So it's a chess game. This is so beautiful. You know, you just do a good job and word of mouth and it grows. And, you know.
Are there any callers that snuck through screening that you remember that are just amazing?
Oh, there were people who could fool us. Yeah. Oh, yes, please. And my call screeners, they were the best. And there was a guy who, I mean, he'd just call and lead us down the primrose path. And he knew how to fake symptoms and describe something and then turn it into the joke. And we'd all feel really, really stupid. But then my call screeners would recognize his voice. And there wasn't actually not a lot of that. But if you knew how to play the game, you know, you can get on a talk show. You got to know how to sound and what to say. And that's what's treacherous because if, for instance, if you wanted to get on, suppose there's some right-wing radio show and you want to, you know, get through the, you want to get on the air and they're not going to let you on if you're honest who you are. You say something that you know they want to hear and get on the air and say, you idiot, da-da-da-da-da-da, and then do your shtick. Not a lot of that. I didn't really have a lot of that. I think I had good call screening, and plus, you'd have to be pretty good to get bias, because you're talking about health, you're talking about perspectives on things that we would deal with. We've often drifted away from health. You can't help that.
Right.
Can't help that.
And you were also, I think, a trailblazer, if you will, in addressing the scientific issues of medicine. You weren't just talking about health, which anyone could talk about health on TV or radio, but like actually defending good science in medicine. How did that something that, like, from the day one, you're like, I'm going to be science-based, or did you just fall into that because you realized you had to?
No, it evolved.
It evolved.
It evolved with my own education. Yeah. You know, when I still have the very, very first show I did on that country music station back in Sacramento on that fateful day it all happened, and you probably wouldn't recognize me. I was a hippie, you know. And yet I was starting to come back down to earth at that particular point. But I, when I just got rabid about medical journals and started reading again, it just slowly came to me rather quickly. And I realized that was more interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw through, you know, pseudoscience pretty quickly. I mean, mm-hmm. I knew there was nothing here. It was wishful thinking. I mean, there's a reason that I don't really have a full grasp on. I love discussing it. You know, what is the lure? And I can go back to the 60s. In the early days, there was something that was, you know, those big bad scientist guys. It was overthrowing the corporate world. Yeah. There was a war. You know, the era was like.
Just anti-establishment.
Anti-establishment. Yeah, yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, I started thinking, it's not really so simple, is it? And it was nice to think, oh, how wonderful that, you know, we can, you know, stop a war, and we can stop certain things, you know, certain corporate practices and certain aspects of the world at that point, by magical thinking is really what it was. And while that movement took off and is what we deal with today, you know, what people call, I don't know, New Age and magical thinking, it didn't exist then. That was just the temper of the times. And everybody rejected, you know, science and medicine, and people went off on their own. I saw horrible things. I had friends who were physicians who went off into alternative medicine, and they were dangerous. They did bad things. Mm-hmm. And it was early and experimental, and nobody understood the boundaries. So I didn't ever open the practice of alternative medicine. I had friends that did. It just wasn't...
When are we talking about? Like in the 70s?
In the late 70s?
Late 70s.
No, early 70s. Early 70s. I have a son who's now, of course, in his 40s, born in 72, born in that bus, actually, that I had. And I did that at home. Oh, my God. That was an epiphany, let me tell you. I'm an ophthalmologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did the obstetrical training like you did in school, and I'm delivering this baby in my bedroom. And all of a sudden, I go, what the am I doing here? This is crazy.
Yep.
And yet everybody was doing it, you know, and he's fine and it's great and all that. But I started realizing that, you know, this was not going to be good. Yeah, medicine could stand a little nudging and a little thoughtfulness about people and not being and learning to communicate and being a little less dogmatic about stuff and allowing. That was the era when you were supposed to be a partner in your healthcare, and which is still a difficult, I know, concept. And there were little things like that, you know, I think straightened me out. But I never forgot the roots. And I think it helped me communicate with people, you know, because of that. When people call about vaccines, I was very sympathetic to what it must be like to somebody who's not medically trained. I mean, I realized, you know, at one point midstream, I really, you know, got into the grateful thing that I'm so lucky to have had a good education. Mm-hmm. You know, what a blessing. I just took it for granted, and that made me a little more dogmatic than I needed to be. But when I realized about that, I got sympathetic to people who don't really understand these things. And a movie star, I mean, we've had some great talks about, you know, celebrity and what it means to a lot of people. Oh, they're a celebrity, therefore they must know about vaccines.
Right.
You know, so to say to them, I get why you're confused. I understand it. But... and then transfer the discussion to helping them make a decision.
So, Dr. Dean, thanks for joining us again on the show. We loved your talk. Again, thanks for your trailblazing career. We really appreciate it.
That's very, very kind of you, and the best to you guys. You're tracing the next trail.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Doctor.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Three regular news items.
Here we go. Item number one. New evidence supports the theory that climactic change, specifically progressive desertification, was largely responsible for the extinction of Australian megafauna about 30,000 years ago. Item number two, new research finds that humans can subconsciously hear a sound delay as brief as 40 milliseconds and use that delay to judge the distance of objects. And item number three, researchers find that the electric eel uses short runs of electrical pulses to cause the muscles of fish prey to contract, thereby giving away their location. Kara, go first.
All righty. New evidence supports the theory that climactic change, specifically progressive desertification, that is a tough one, largely responsible for the extinction of Australian megafauna about 30,000 years ago. I guess that's true. There aren't that many really big things in Australia, except for bats. They have huge bats.
They're awesome and beautiful.
I know. Yeah, they are awesome. I mean, 30,000 years is long enough ago to have these big climactic changes. Like they, you know, we think of them as being millions of years ago, but they definitely, these cycles can happen in tens of thousands of years. So I don't know. It could be legitimate. Let's see. New research finds that humans can subconsciously hear a sound delay as brief as 40 milliseconds and use that delay to judge the distance of objects. Ooh, this one, anytime I hear anything about the subconscious, I do start to get like my tingly skeptical radar goes up. Not that there isn't a subconscious and not that there isn't good data to support that there are some things we can measure, but so much of that has been bastardized into bad, bad science, or bad conclusions based on legitimate science. Let me see. Researchers find that the electric eel uses short runs of electrical pulses to cause the muscles of fish prey to contract, thereby giving away their location. Whose? The eel's or the fish's location?
The fish's. So like the eel is swimming in the water and there are fish hiding in the mud or something. And they're just sending out these little bolts of electricity.
And it causes like dystonia or
causes
something.
Causes the fish to spasm and that spasming causes, you know, disturbs the water and the way and causes waves, which then give away the fish's location. Huh. So that's how they're trolling for prey, basically.
Gotcha. So this to me seems legitimate. I mean, if you think about it, water is a very good conductor of electricity. The electric eel, we know, can like shock that if you touch it, it can be dangerous. Why wouldn't they be able to pass a pulse to something that's close by? Electricity does cause, as if you've ever seen somebody who was like struck by lightning or stuck their finger in a wall socket, it can cause that like kind of tonic, that convulsion in the muscles. So I'm sure number two is right because you're getting me, but I'm gonna go with my first instinct and say that the subconscious sound delay is gonna be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, the desertification one sounds reasonable, although it makes a lot of sense. Although, I mean, why wouldn't some species have just migrated to the more comfortable, you know, coastal areas. So I don't know about that one. The sound
they're not
delay,
migratory.
Non-migratory.
Migratory.
Now, the distance one, the sound delay, you mean, did you mean to say not the distance, but the location of objects? You actually meant distance?
I meant distance.
See, that's what's throwing me on that one because...
Yeah, so in other words, you're actually perceiving the difference between, you know, the visual information and auditory information because the sound is a little delayed and that even a 40 millisecond delay
is enough
what
you're saying.
For your brain to say, oh, that's how far away that thing is.
Oh, man. 40 milliseconds? Oh, that's got to be 30 feet away. I'm not buying that at all. All right, I'm going to do a GWC. I'm going to pick a sound delay as fiction as well.
Okay, Evan.
What's GWC?
Go with Kara.
Go with Kara.
Go with Kara.
Go with Kara.
Duh.
You made a good point, Kara, about the sound one, the subconscious part of it. Maybe you can hear the sound delay. Maybe your brain can do that. But to be able to judge the distance based on that, I didn't buy that either. So I'll say that one's the fiction.
And Jay?
Well, as far as the second one about the sound delay, so this is what I know. I know that we can pick up the sound delay difference between our ears, not between what we see and what we hear, but between
right.
our ears.
And that gives us distance. That gives us location.
That gives us location, and I think that could help with distance as well, no? I know it's definitely location. But wow, the judge, the distance of objects. That's pretty interesting because you're using your visual and sound. That's freaking really, really cool if we're doing that. You know, the one about the progressive desertification, that seems reasonable, and I have no reason to argue that. Now, this one about the electric eels, that's interesting too. I know a few things about electric eels because I just find them to be interesting. I like the whole idea about how they generate the electricity and everything, but I don't know much about why they actually discharge it other than like get away from me, leave me alone type reaction. But I don't know. I do think that for something about the sound one, I think is real because of what I already knew about this. So I think I'm going to say the electric eel one's a fake.
Okay. So that means you all agree with the first one. So we'll start there. New evidence supports the theory that climactic change, specifically progressive desertification, was largely responsible for the extinction of Australian megafauna about 30,000 years ago. You all think that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
Ah,
what was
the first one? My gut.
Yep. Oh, there's that. Oh, my gut. Right off the bat.
Oh man.
You got us on another one with Australian animals.
Yeah.
You remember?
Rule of thumb.
There's like
I shouldn't
a dragon
tell you this.
Or something.
Yeah, yeah. Rule of thumb. It's always the people. People have caused all the extinctions any time within the last 30,000 years.
Oh, yeah.
That's too close. You're right. 200,000 years or less, it's probably people.
Yeah, it's probably people. So that's what the evidence actually showed. And what they did was the researchers looked at the timing of the disappearance of Australian megafauna. So, you know, between 30 to 40,000 years ago, up to that point, there were lots of like giant, you know, by modern standards, giant lizards, and there were giant kangaroos, and there was a marsupial lion, large terrestrial birds,
cool.
A giant wombat, lots of giant megafauna in Australia, and they died out between 27 and 40,000 years ago, so roughly around 30,000 years ago. The question was, how did that relate to the arrival of human beings on the Australian continent? And what the researchers found is that, so people were there for between... They arrived in Australia between 50 and 61,000 years ago. The question was, had some of those species, the megafauna, were they already going extinct by that time? And what this new survey found was, nope, that they actually, the range of extinction time was between 27 and 40,000 years, on average about 14,000 years after the humans arrived, which is, you know, about how long it would have taken for humans to spread around the continent, develop their hunting, and wipe out all the megafauna. So this obviously isn't proof that that's what happened, but that supports the hypothesis, that human activity is what drove a lot of the megafauna to extinction. That mirrors, as I was saying, that mirrors, you know, evidence from other continents. Yeah, pretty much wherever humans go, there's mass extinction follows. So that fits the pattern. Okay, let's go to number two. New research finds that humans can subconsciously hear a sound delay as brief as 40 milliseconds and use that delay to judge the distance of objects. Bob, Kara, and Evan thought that was the fiction, but that one is science, of course. That was very cool. Very cool. And,
yeah,
you know,
I
have to thank you, Kara, for you said the magic words. I threw in the word subconscious specifically to tick that little skeptical red flag. But that's what the research shows. What they did was they tested people judging the distance of virtual objects, and they either paired them with the sound delay or not. And even when the visual information said that the two objects were at the same distance, when they paired one object with a sound delay, people estimated them as being farther away, you know, sort of congruent with the time delay. And so in their study, people were not aware of the time delay, but the between the visual and the audio information, but it was a cue, a subconscious cue that influenced their judgment of how far away something was, and that effect was there down to a delay of 40 milliseconds, which is amazing. That is a very short amount of time. This makes sense in light of what we know. We know that all of our senses influence how our other senses interpret data. It's all contextual, you know. Just like we talked about the McGurk effect, when you see people's lips moving, that affects how you hear the sound that they're making. It actually affects what you hear, how your brain constructs the sound that you hear. In this case, if there is a sound delay, then we interpret maybe ambiguous visual information to say, oh, this there's a slight delay. It must be farther away, even if we don't consciously perceive the sound delay. It's just all subconscious sensory processing. So makes sense. Again, it's one study. You know, it needs to be replicated and, you know, explored. But the data seem pretty robust.
Love it.
And I almost did an all-electric eel theme this week because there's so many cool facts about electric eels. So researchers find that the electric eel uses short runs of electrical pulses to cause the muscles of fish prey to contract, thereby giving away the location. Jay thought that one is fiction, but that is science. So yeah, so recent studies of electric eels found that they do all kinds of interesting things with their electricity. It was previously known that they would stun their prey, or that they would use it as a defense mechanism to get away from predators, but that it was kind of just like a one little dumb shock, you know, that they would just release whenever they were on top of prey to stun it. But they actually use the electrical fields in a much more sophisticated and controlled way for a variety of reasons. So we know, like, for example, that they can just produce an area of effect shock, right? They can emit a shock of about 600 volts. That's a lot.
Ooh.
And that's just to escape, like Jay said? That works
to stun prey, too, as well.
Oh, okay.
In fact, when they're stunning prey, they can curl their head and their tail around, because like the head is their like the positive electrode and the tail is a negative electrode, and cool. They could double the intensity of the electrical charge that they give off on that prey that they trap between their head and their tail. But they also found that they can release these doublets and triplets, these little brief runs of smaller shocks as they're hunting. And when they do that, so like if they're, because these eels live in like muddy waters that have lots of plants and there's lots of places for their prey to hide. And so they're just cruising along, sending out these little doublets and triplets of shocks. And if they get close to a fish that maybe is hiding in the mud, it'll twitch and contract and it'll move and give away its location. And then it goes after it.
That's awesome.
And these are just, they said, short sequences of 2 to 3 millisecond high voltage pulses while hunting.
High voltage.
Very cool. Yeah. So, yeah. Electric eels are very cool. 2/3 of their body is covered with these electrocytes. Electrocytes are cells that have been evolutionarily modified in order to store up these electrical charge that then could be released at will.
Oh my God, I want those so bad.
Yeah.
That would be my superhero. I would have electrocytes.
Totally, totally. All cells are electrical. That's the thing. It's not like this is a completely new ability that it has no precedent. All of your cells are electrical, and muscles and nerve cells are specialized to use the electrical, you know, potential across the cell membrane in order to do stuff, contract or send signals. And this is just one step beyond that, you know.
Yeah, because that's in millivolts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is probably in like volts, right?
This is, as I said, 600 volts. Yeah. But it's all about getting a whole bunch of cells to do it all together, right?
That makes sense. But it doesn't damage that. Well, obviously, they evolved for it to not damage cells and not screw up all of those ion concentrations. But it's so cool. I want to like just zap people with my fingertips, like beyond just walking across the, you know, the living room in my socks.
Yeah, that definitely would be a cool power. So I was actually surprised I got you all this week. I didn't think I was going to get you with this one.
I know. It's like you made it so obvious that, I don't know.
I know. I fully dismissed it.
It was not obvious enough.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, exactly. All right, that's a gimme. Bye.
Very, very awesome news today, right now. This is a huge thing you and I are about to reveal.
Yes.
What?
Be excited. We are auctioning off 2 sets of 2 tickets to see...
2 pairs of tickets, yeah.
2 pairs of tickets to see Star Wars with the SGU and our gigantic entourage. This is also going to include us doing a live movie review of the movie right after we see it and a party that night at Steve's house in our studio.
Yeah, so you basically get to hang out with us for the day, come to see Star Wars with us, and watch us record our live Star Wars review. So we're going to be seeing the movie on December 19th, that is Saturday, and we're going to allow any of our listeners to basically do like a silent auction. Just email us your bid if you want to submit a bid for these tickets. There'll be 2 pairs, so you're basically bidding on a pair of tickets.
Yep, base pairs.
This is in a theater that has reserved seating, so I reserved a huge block of seats, and it's going to be all of the Rogues, all of our family, a lot of our local skeptics and friends. But we wanted to open it up to listeners as well. This is how it's going to work. It's a little complicated, so just bear with me for a second. So send us your bid, and also tell us what your membership level is. And essentially, we're going to add your bid to the value of your membership, the annual value of your membership, and that will be the number that gets compared. So anybody could win the auction if you bid enough, but members will have a slight edge because their membership will count towards the total
bid. That's a cool idea.
And
yeah, I like that.
If you are not a member and you win the bid, we'll give you a membership, right? The money
cool.
you pay for the tickets will go towards a membership as well.
Yeah, that'll be a one-year
Bonus.
Membership. Nice. Now, the email, please put Star Wars tickets.
In the subject, yeah. So obviously, we're in Connecticut in the United States. You're completely responsible for your travel. we're just giving you the tickets and the ability to hang out with us for the day. So if you're local, obviously it's a lot easier, but anyone is welcome if you want to get yourself here.
And I'll be there too. You know, I'm all the way on the West Coast, but I'm coming.
Yeah, Kara will physically Yay. Be there. Yeah, she will be Yay. With us. And we'll have our new lightsabers to play with. Send your bid and your membership level to info@theskepticsguide.org with the subject line Star Wars tickets, and we will keep the bids open until midnight on Tuesday, November 10th. So that way we'll
Eastern
have
Eastern Standard Time.
Eastern Standard Time. That way we'll be able to announce the winners in 2 weeks.
Yeah, keep in mind, guys, the winners are going to be spending, you know, about 12 hours with us, start to finish. And you're going right. to see us record the interview and hang out at the party afterwards, have dinner, the whole bit.
Love it.
All right, Evan, give us the quote of the week.
Cognitive psychology tells us that the unaided human mind is vulnerable to many fallacies and illusions because of its reliance on its memory for vivid anecdotes rather than systematic statistics. And that was penned by Steven Pinker.
Steven Pinker's awesome.
Yes, he is. From the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. He conducts research on language and cognition, and he writes for all sorts of publications, which I'm sure you've read.
I love his book, The Blank Slate.
Ooh, I got to add that to my list.
Yeah, yeah, very, very good. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me this week.
You're welcome, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. Thank you.